Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
3,631.17. There the NASDAQ got today, and there it stayed for a very, very long time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 22nd of August. Good as always to have you with us. And here in a nutshell is what happened on Wall Street today. The NASDAQ broke. The second biggest stock exchange in this country just stopped for 3 hours. No buying, no selling, no nothing. Heidi Moore from the Guardian newspaper is with us to explain. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So what the heck? The whole NASDAQ shut down?
Not just the NASDAQ. It was a broad market outage, and it was a software glitch. I mean, not dissimilar to the one that you get when your computer refuses to cooperate with you, except on a much larger scale. The NASDAQ has software that publishes the stock prices of all the companies that are listed on the exchange. And these are really big companies, Apple, Facebook, Intel, that kind of thing. And so that software went down, and that meant that over 2,000 stocks and options couldn't have their quotes published, their stock prices published. And that meant that not only was the NASDAQ halted, but you couldn't buy Apple stock on the New York Stock Exchange or anywhere else. By some estimates, that's $5.7 trillion of money just stopped in its tracks.
Do we know why? Do we know what the technical glitch was?
We don't know the entirety of it. All we know is that something happened with the software. And of course, we know from previous glitches like this, like the flash crash in 2010, that investigations can go on and we can never find out.
This has been a tough week for flash crashes and glitches, right? You had the Goldman Sachs thing earlier, and then a year ago, there was a company that basically went bust because of this. I mean, it's not good news.
It's not good news. And it's really made people think about regulation, right? A lot of these exchanges don't have backup systems. I mean, with the NASDAQ, you'd expect that, fine, maybe your software goes down, but you have a backup like we all do or should. But they don't have that. So there's regulation that's proposed right now that would force them to submit to an audit by regulators. The regulators would walk around the back offices and see, you know, is your technology in order? Do you have good backups? Mm-hmm. Can the market depend on you? And I think that's going to become a really important factor in the coming weeks and months. This might be the straw that broke the camel's back for regulation of the market.
Yeah. Do you actually believe that?
I hope it. Yeah. I hope it fervently. And I guess that's all we can ever do.
If I had a buy order in today for 100 shares of Apple and at that instant the NASDAQ went zzz, what happened to my order?
The NASDAQ has no pity for you. So sometimes they cancel their orders and they do that automatically from their end. But in this case, they're saying you are going to have to call your broker and cancel it yourself before trading starts again.
That's insane. There are bajillions of orders out there.
Well, you know, you should be attentive. But yes, it's a huge pain in the neck.
Where do we go from here? I mean, do we think it's going to be back to normal tomorrow? Can you trust the markets anymore? This is just a whole kettle of fish.
Yeah. I mean, it builds on a lot of, eroding confidence in market stability. If you have your 401k in the market or if you have a million shares of Goldman Sachs stock, you're feeling equally nervous. You want to know that you aren't going to have these disruptions. And so far, nothing much has come out of these flash crashes, even though we've seen these glitches really increase as the technology has become advanced. So what we hope to see is that there might be more regulation. There might be more discussion of this topic leading to the exchanges to take better care of their technology and evaluate themselves. The worst possible outcome, of course, is that we move past it, trading starts again, and we forgot it ever happened, like with the Goldman Sachs thing this week.
Heidi Moore from The Guardian, also every now and then from our weekly wrap on Fridays. Heidi, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
The White House says President Obama was indeed briefed about the events of the day on Wall Street as they were unfolding. But you do kind of have to believe he's a little bit miffed that the market stole his thunder. He started a big bus tour today up in western New York State, one of the goals of which is to talk about the cost of higher education.
We understand that in the face of greater and greater global competition in a knowledge-based economy, a great education is more important than ever. A higher education is the single best investment you can make in your future. And I'm proud of all the students who are making that investment.
And so the president went on to say the White House wants to tie federal student aid to a new rating system. That system would take into account data on graduation rates, tuition costs, student loan debt, and even how much money graduates make after they leave school. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Let's start with this basic question. Has federal aid money made college tuition more expensive?
Virtually all of the research that's been done suggests it has not.
David Longenecker is president of the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. One exception where student loan programs have contributed to higher tuition rates?
At some types of institutions, particularly at the for-profit sector institutions.
The list price at both private and public universities has risen much faster than median income, according to higher education economist Robert Archibald.
Net price, you know, when you factor in financial aid, has not gone up nearly as much, though I think still faster than median income.
It's important to point out that 75% of students attend public universities, where financially pressed states have been raising tuition rates faster than private universities.
If the federal government really wanted to directly affect the problem of state finance for higher education, single most effective thing they could do is to get the rising costs of state Medicaid programs down.
Jane Wellman is executive director of the Delta Project on post-secondary costs. She says public college tuition is going up because rising health care costs from Medicaid are consuming state dollars that used to go to education. This is one issue that the president's new plan doesn't address. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Back to the train wreck that was Wall Street today. The Nasdaq came back online about a half an hour before the close this afternoon. All three major indices ended in the green when all was said and done. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're getting in your last licks of summer this week and next, maybe you'll be heading to a national park for a little bit of nature. It's free this Sunday, by the way, as the Park Service celebrates its 97th birthday. But if you do go, a quick heads up, you're going to want to bring a trash bag. Kate Davidson explains.
A couple weeks ago, I went for a day hike in Great Falls Park in Virginia. My friend Stephanie Van Beber came too, along with her little kid and their dog. Now, as happens with little kids and dogs, nature called in a rather inconvenient place. And by the end, Steph was carrying something one of our group left behind. It was in a bag, tightly cinched.
It's from one of my walking partners. And now I want a trash can.
But there weren't trash cans on the trail, or in the big picnic area, or even the bathroom. That's because Great Falls removed its trash cans this year as part of a new waste management strategy. Carry in, carry out is a core backcountry principle. Applying it here in this land of baby diapers and grills and hamburger wrappers means changing behavior.
I was shocked. I've just never been in a park where they don't have trash cans.
Ricky and Lynn Bush are having a family cookout. She's a little annoyed since they had to pay to get into the park. On the other hand, she says,
it actually looks much cleaner because usually when you come here, the trash cans are overflowing, so it actually looks nicer.
It turns out when people are asked to take their trash home, they generally do. The proof is right across the river, where the C&O Canal National Historical Park has been trash can free for more than a decade. The Great Falls site manager says his program is rooted in sustainability. For other parks, it's about sequestration and budget cuts.
Well, we had to reduce costs this year, like all of the national parks.
Patty Wissinger is superintendent of the Chattahoochee River National Recreation Area in Georgia. That's where 3.2 million people go every year to beat the Atlanta heat.
Trash operations and picking up litter are pretty expensive for us because we're spread out 48 miles. We have 18 different recreation areas in those 48 miles that we've got trash cans at.
Or did until April, when they took out 134 of them. The fuel, vehicle, and labor savings add up to about $76,000, still just part of Chattahoochee's required budget cuts. And Chattahoochee's not alone. National parks in Massachusetts, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Mississippi have all reduced or removed trash cans as budgets have tightened in recent years. Patty Wissinger says she's been pleasantly surprised how supportive people are. She says there's just one group of holdouts.
What we just haven't seemed to be able to conquer yet is how to get people to take their pet waste with them when they leave the park.
They just leave it in politely tied baggies along the trail. But Wissinger also points out that years ago, nobody bagged their pet waste at all. Behavior does change. And as trash cans disappear from parks, it will just have to change a little faster. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
There's healthcare news from an unlikely source today. UPS is going to eliminate health benefits for spouses of their employees, spouses who can get health insurance through their own jobs, it should be said. The decision does affect only a fraction of the UPS workforce, but it might be a sneak peek at the way healthcare is going to work from now on. Anne Hepperman has that story.
Melissa Thomason sort of knows what it means for your company to eliminate spousal health benefits. Her employer, Miami University, cut spouses off a few years ago.
Luckily, I'm not married.
Thomason is a health economist. She says UPS's decision is part of the new healthcare reality. As the Affordable Care Act takes shape, she says, employers are rethinking their health insurance policies.
This will force some high-cost members off of health insurance plans and help companies rein in costs.
Ann Thomason says some employers may use those savings to eventually give back to their workers.
Hopefully, down the line, we would see that in an improved ability of employers to offer more generous wage increases.
But some health experts say that UPS's decision shows how companies may use Obamacare as a punching bag. At the American Institutes for Research, Marilyn Moon says companies who decided to put health benefits on the chopping block can now say,
wow, here's a great way to do it and blame it on the Affordable Care Act.
Some employers are also trying a carrot-and-stick approach, like making smokers pay higher premiums or rewarding them if they kick the habit. Deborah Chollet is a health economist at Mathematica Policy Research. She says companies have been tinkering with health benefits for years, and people shouldn't be reading too much into UPS's decision.
We may see other, you know, like-minded employers doing the same kind of thing. But with respect to the impacts on employees, it's minimal.
Because, says Chollet, Obamacare will offer workers or their spouses other health care options. In New York, I'm Ann Hepperman for Marketplace.
Coming up, you think you know the value of a hard-earned dollar?
If we hauled 1,000 bales in a day, we got $2.50.
Another first job, a tough one this time. But first, let's do the numbers. As we talked about already, trading was halted on the NASDAQ for a good spell today, but that didn't stop the buying on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials broke its losing streak, added 66 points. The blue chips did 0.4%, 14,963 at the bell. Despite all the downtime, the NASDAQ jumped 38 points, more than a full percent, finished at 3638, and the S&P 500 ticked up 14 points, 0.75%. Ended things at 1656. Now, the NASDAQ isn't just an exchange. It's a publicly traded enterprise, and that parent company, NASDAQ OMX, shed 3.5% after the trading black eye today. On the other hand, the tech stocks listed on the NASDAQ paused for the delay and then kept on a going. Yahoo charged up 3% after we learned the website topped Google as the most visited domain on the internet. There's some qualifiers there you might want to read up on. Slumping PC sales sent Hewlett-Packard stock down 12%. Bond prices, while they held steady, the yield on the 10-year T-note remains at 2.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for July. Let the brainstorming begin. Engineers and others interested in climbing their way to the final frontier are meeting in Seattle. The 2013 Space Elevator Conference gets underway. And Jesse, look out. He's got concert dates coming up around the country. Singer and actor Rick Springfield turns 64. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. After a long couple of economic years, there's been some good news over in the UK the past few months. The recovery there is happening. Consumers' spending is up and home prices are rising at their fastest rate in 7 years. But there is some discontent over a decision by the British government to pump billions of pounds into a plan to help home buyers. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story from London.
The Brits love to shop, and 29-year-old Meg George is no exception. But there's one prospective purchase that fills Meg with dismay.
So that's £320,000. It's in New Cross. It's not even a nice area. £249,500, and it's horrible.
Standing outside a realtor's office in London, Meg is looking at properties for sale, and she's feeling
depressed, excluded, you know, kind of hopeless.
Her dream of owning her own home in London seems as distant as ever.
I'm not broke. I've got a job. My partner has a job. We're reasonably well paid. But there is no chance that we would ever be able to afford a normal house.
Like hundreds of thousands of other Brits, they can't get a big enough mortgage because lending standards are tight and they're being priced out of the market by landlords buying property to rent out. But the government is riding to the rescue. Finance Chief George Osborne is extending a plan to offer home buyers an interest-free loan worth up to 20% of the purchase price of a property.
It is aimed directly at families who can't afford to move up on the housing ladder, can't afford to buy their first home because of problems in the mortgage market, not because they themselves, as families, can't afford a home.
His Help to Buy scheme is popular. The hankering for home ownership in Britain is widespread and intense, powerfully evoked by this song used for many years as a theme tune for a leading mortgage lender. But the government is not only seeking votes by feeding a national obsession. Residential property is the single biggest item of British household wealth. Gillian Tett of the Financial Times says if you want to revive Britain's consumer-dominated economy, you give house prices a boost.
What the government's trying to do with Help to Buy is a bit like putting a fire lighter on a damp summer barbecue, and they're hoping you'll get a blaze and that will basically get consumer sentiment going and get everyone feeling more positive.
Thank you. Next, please.
Trouble is, the UK economy isn't flagging anymore. Consumer confidence is returning, and after several years in the doldrums, the housing market is hotting up again. Critics are lining up to attack the government's home loan measure.
There isn't a single economist that I've spoken to who thinks that the government's current scheme, Help to Buy, is a good idea.
Commentator Shiv Malik describes the scheme as inflationary and self-defeating.
As everyone gets in on this sort of taxpayer-funded bonanza, then again, house prices will rise and a lot more people will be left behind.
Critics say the government is setting up another house price bubble, which will inevitably burst. And this time, taxpayers will be directly underwriting billions of dollars worth of home loans. Gillian Tett says it'll be a rerun of the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac fiasco.
The idea the UK would now be picking up that same kind of scheme, to my mind, is simply bonkers.
The government claims that its Help to Buy scheme is stimulating more house building and that prices should level off as the supply of property rises. But it's a risky tactic. No one forgets that two of the key ingredients in the last financial disaster were easy money and a house price boom. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coffee snobs might want to turn off the radio for the next What's it going to run? About 2.5 minutes or so. Because what I'm about to tell you may well make you spit up your cappuccino. The best-selling coffee brand in stores in this country is, wait for it now, hang on, Folgers. Not Starbucks, not those single country of origin shade-grown beans you get from your corner cafe. It's Folgers. Vanessa Wong wrote it up in Bloomberg Businessweek. Vanessa, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So give me the skinny. How much better is Folgers doing in the market than all the rest of the coffees out there?
Folgers has a pretty solid lead in the coffee market. And according to most recent data, they had an average 15.6% market share in the U.S.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big lead. The second best-selling brand of coffee was Maxwell House. And then private labels ranked third. Green Mountain Coffee, surprisingly, came in fourth with 4.3%.
Right, we're down to fourth already, and you haven't mentioned Starbucks, which I thought was taking over the world.
Yeah, you'd think, right?
Yeah.
Starbucks held only 3.3%, and I think that's because most people prefer to drink Starbucks at the restaurants, rather than from the grocery channel.
Well, you know, it's funny. We actually shop for coffee at Costco, and I use Costco. But it's, you know, it's made in my own kitchen, and it's tasty there, and that's the whole deal. Although I have my occasional Starbucks, too.
Right. Well, I'll have to admit myself, I do enjoy brewing Cafe Bustelo myself,
aha,
which is also a J.M. Smucker brand.
It's the whole conglomerate thing, right? I mean, Folgers has the oomph of Smucker's behind it, right?
Right, exactly. So Smucker also produces Dunkin' Donuts packaged coffee, mm-hmm, for example, another brand called Café Pilon. Of course, their leading one is Folgers, though.
I will reveal myself to be a coffee snob here, though, and offer that Folgers just isn't really all that good. I mean, you know, best part of waking up and the whole jingle thing and all that, you know, notwithstanding. Come on.
The brand now is trying to stay relevant to millennials. So one of the things that an executive mentioned during their recent earnings call was that their marketing efforts have been successful, including a Folgers jingle contest,
mm-hmm,
which resulted in a video with three guys singing about coffee in,
yep,
a field, and it was very folksy and soothing.
well, let's hit a little bit of that. Let's play that. You know what? It's just not doing it for me, man. I'm just saying.
Maybe it's, you know, you have to be a millennial to really
like,
yeah, it. It feels a little bit like Jack Johnson meets Mumford & Sons or something
with a twist
of caffeine or something.
But coffee sales are up overall, right? I mean, we're still drinking buckets full of this stuff.
We're drinking so much coffee. And we're drinking more Folgers coffee, too. So we all probably just need a nap, but it's easier to get a coffee in the middle of the day.
Fair enough. Vanessa Wong from Bloomberg Businessweek. Vanessa, thanks a bunch.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kai.
We're doing a series this week about first jobs, what it was like to walk into that new office, or today, that new barn.
I'm Kennard Lennox, Rolla, Missouri, and I have a cattle ranch here, and it's my wife and I are by ourselves on it. The four kids have all gone, so we're running it and enjoying our life. My first job was, that I got paid for anyway, hauling hay. If we hauled 1,000 bales in a day, we got $2.50. So I would show up at the man that owned the trucks, the hauler, place about noon, and then the crew would all show up there, and we'd go to the hayfield, wherever it was. You rode on the back of the truck, and we all had water jugs and everything. And when we started working in the morning or at noon, we didn't quit, really, until the hay was in the barn. You had to back into the barn and stack it the way the rancher wanted it stacked. You know, it may be 10, 15, 20 bales high. And if it was in the daytime, the sun hitting on that big old barn, closed-in barn, it may be 110 degrees in there. That was the worst part of the job, was stacking it in the barn. That was excruciating. What the job taught me was possibly the value of money and how hard it was to earn it, and you didn't spend it, you know, foolishly. I see some of the fellows that hauled hay with me in town. Some of them are insurance brokers, bankers, you know, different things, and we'll laugh and talk about how they hauled hay. Some of them didn't last long, you know. That first day, it was just too much. But some of them, it was, you know, they were proud of what they did, that they could stand it.
I'll tell you what, I could listen to him talk all day long. Ken Lennox is a cattle rancher in Rolla, Missouri. We talk to him from time to time about his cows and his land. Send us a note with a story of your first job. It's letters@marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note as we close today, in which we learn technology is really the least of our problems when it comes to market glitches. There are fat finger trades, there are flash crashes and Black Tuesdays and all the rest. And then there are squirrels. They have taken the NASDAQ offline twice in the past 25 years, once in 1994 by chewing through a cable, and once in 1987 by short-circuiting some power lines. The squirrel in that one, sadly, didn't make it out alive. And that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Come on. It was funny. A little bit. The Dow Industrials broke its losing streak, added 66 points, 0.4%, closed at 14,963. Despite all the downtime, the NASDAQ up 38 points, more than a full percent, 3638. The S&P 500 ticked up 14 points, 0.75%, ended things at 1655. John Buckley, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. And this is APM.